All right, so we are again in the final section. As we talked about, you know, there are a few things that he makes mention of in chapter 9 and emphasizes, and the book's not intended to be a verse-by-verse study anyway, so he's covering high points that he wants to cover in these different sections of Scripture. So, verses 12 through 18, he just quickly makes a note of some other words of wisdom that are found here. Would someone go ahead and read for me verses 12 through 18, and then we'll look at a couple of points before we get into the discussion questions. Thank you, Lord.
We're in 9, right?
Yes, okay. Yes, chapter 9.
For man also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the son of man are snared in an evil time, when it falls suddenly upon them. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no one remembered the same poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good.
Okay. Oh, good. Now, the first thing I wanted to note is that he mentions letter D right above the final words of wisdom as verse 11 teaching that we're to be satisfied with who we are because, as stated there, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise. I don't think that's the primary point of what is being said in verses 11 and 12. It's a legitimate point to make that we need to do the best we can and not be overly concerned about what we're not. And there's some truth to that. But I think 11 and 12 are tied in together. And this is, in fact, an indication, again, of the vanity of life. And it is, in effect, saying that life is not as we desire it to be. Life is not always fair. The race is not to the swift. In other words, you have a person who runs fastest. You would think he would win the race, but that's not the way life works. He's not saying it's not the way a race works, because typically that is the way the race works. But he's saying life is not how we would expect it to be. And a big part of that, life not being as we would expect it to be. We recognize that the powerful, the strong, the influential, time and chance happens. So they can be brought low just as easily as a poor man. But he ties that in with the end of life. And it's very similar to what is stated in James when he talks about the arrogance of men who say that I'm going to go in such and such a city and I'm going to buy and sell and make a profit. He said, you don't know what will happen. That's what he's saying here. Your life is a vapor that appears for a little while and vanishes away. We don't know what's on the morrow. And verse 12 tells us a man does not know his time. And this is a cruelty. This is stated in cruel terms. The fish taken in a cruel net and a bird caught in a snare. The sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. So the idea is that we're... And it's the same basic principle that's established a number of times in the New Testament, whether it be in James' words or the story that Jesus gave about the rich man who fared sumptuously and his soul was required of him that night, and he was making preparations for a long life because he did not make himself right with God. And this is the lesson, and there are allusions to this lesson throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. So the idea is our life is a vapor. We don't have any guarantees of tomorrow. And if what we're trying to do is to be treated fairly in the life that we have on this earth, we're going to be, I think, disappointed in that, because it just doesn't work that way. And so instead, of course, there is that call to prepare for eternity, which is the conclusion that we'll get to in a few farther chapters.
I was going to say, and you just kind of finish it, but what I take from that is God is fair. It may not seem fair the way we see it in this earth, but it's equal across the board. We're all susceptible to the same things, maybe at different times in life, but money doesn't always mean that you can't get cancer or anything like that. So it is a fair, maybe not in what we see, but God is equally among us all.
But what we're looking at, and everyone is this way, we're self-centric. So we have our own welfare that we're concerned about. And one thing for us to keep in mind as Christians is the fact that as we live for the Lord and we're seeking to do righteousness, and then bad things happen to us, then there would, I think, be the tendency for us as Christians sometimes to say, hey, I was doing it right. Why did this happen to me? And you have individuals who may, they may be unhealthy in their lifestyles and do a lot of things that they shouldn't, and still they live a long life, and someone who's doing everything right but genetics hits or something else, and either accident or some disease hits them that's not expected, those kinds of things. And then we rail against the unfairness of it all, and I think you're right, Laura, in the recognition that that happens to everyone. So there is that sense of it's equally distributed. In other words, it's not just us being singled out by a malevolent supernatural being that wants to harm us and hurt us. The second thing to keep in mind beyond this is that while the world is in the state it is in, which, by the way, is our own fault, not his, the fact is that God never forgets us, but he sees on the other side of eternity. He sees beyond what we sometimes are able. And if we can alter our perspective sufficiently, then we can handle it better, and certainly know that as difficult as this life is, the next life is going to be better, and that's sometimes helpful for us. But there is, again, a pretty I wouldn't say a negative tone, a despairing tone that is found in some of these verses throughout that we've noticed, and it's all with that idea is, you know, you look around, Solomon's looking around, he says, you know, there's just a lot of things in life that just doesn't seem right. and as long as we're thinking about, okay, I've only got 85, 90 years, however, you know, depending, of course, it was shorter back then, but I've got this number of years that I can live on this earth, and then that I'm hit with this, that's not fair. You know, it just, because it's going to ruin this portion of my life, or I can't do what I once could, or I'm sick, or I've lost my home, or whatever the case may be. And it's like, you know, there are a lot of people who despair and even contemplate suicide, other kinds of things, as a result of just being obsessed with the fact that their life has not turned out the way they wanted it to, or some unfortunate event has happened to them that has been very destructive to their well-being and welfare. It happens not just to them, it happens to everyone, or everyone is susceptible to it, put it that way. But again, we always want to put that perspective on, is that there is eternity in the future, and that's his conclusion as well. It's just that it's not something that he emphasizes over and over as he's saying these things. Sometimes he waits to the end to say it. And there are glimpses of it throughout the text. But I just felt that it's important to note that verses 11 and 12 are tied together, and so that means, like I said, he does this a number of times. He makes a point that perhaps you can derive from the text, but it's not primarily what the text is teaching. And I thought that was the case there. All right, anybody else about verse 12? Next section is verses 13 through 16, and that is, the mind will win over muscle, although the value of wisdom is sometimes lost. And the point is making there of that story. He said, a little city with few men in it, a great king came and besieged it, built snares. There was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no one remembered the poor man. And that just is, again, an indication of the way things work. It's quite often the case that individuals who are the most helpful, because it's not what society perceives as being most important, that what they've accomplished and such is not remembered. And there are a number of reasons for that. The foolishness of men's lack of gratitude, but you see it quite often. And it seems like the ones that are remembered are the loudest individuals rather than the wisest. You make more of an impact by making noise. You've got a man speaking with quiet words of wisdom who delivers the day. That's not something that's always going to be known. I just wonder how that kind of is in world events, how often that kind of thing happens. The people who are working behind the scenes, you've got the blowhards out front that are getting all of the attention, but it's the people who are making the good decisions and supplying the wisdom that we may never know who they are, but they're the ones that are actually accomplishing the good that is needed. And I think that's one of the things about what you'll see often in marriages as well. The wisdom of the wife is something that's often overlooked. There's that saying that's not popular because it's not politically correct today, but behind every great man there is a great woman. And I think there's truth to that quite often, so that's something to keep in mind. All right, anything about 13 through 16 that you want to add? And then finally, the last two, quiet wisdom speaks louder than anything, verse 7. The words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Notice it says should be. And so his statement is, while there's legitimacy to it, is that it is the most important thing to be said. A lot of times it's not what is heard, unfortunately, which is what we pointed out. And then the last verse, verse 18, and that is, one person's selfishness can destroy much good. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. And I think that we probably have seen that in our lives.
I just think of David in that. He's against a giant, but yet all he had was the slingshot. Wisdom was the faith in God. So.
Good. That's a good point. All right. So, any questions about that last section? A lot of good material there. All right, let's go to the discussion questions and see what you think about these. So, the first question talks about the day. Every day we get to choose what our attitude, priorities, thinking, commitments, our faith, relations, our values, our areas of improvement, what those are going to be, how we're going to work with those. And then we get to do it again all over tomorrow. Each day matters. It's too late for yesterday. You can't depend on tomorrow. You have today. So today matters. So discuss. What they're asking is, and I'm not sure exactly what he's wanting us to derive from this, but you may have an idea of something you want to add. The principle that we want to discuss is, you will never change your life until you change what you do daily. I think that's legitimate. But what do you want to discuss about it? Is there anything to discuss besides making the point? That idea of not procrastinating would come up with regard to that, a resolution to be consistent. So consistency and working, not putting off to tomorrow what you should be doing today. All of those things are important. But just the point itself, that you will never change your life until you change what you do daily. What's that they say about having a lot of small goals instead of one big goal?
Realistic,
and something realistic and attainable each day, and then the accumulation of those goals will accomplish the big one down the road. And there's a lot of truth to that, because if you say that I want to make this great gigantic change in my life, and it's going to take months or years to accomplish it. That's something that's a little bit difficult. Take, for example, with regard to writing. It's an interesting thing with me. I've always, and I mentioned this to y'all before, I've always wanted to write a novel, but it's a daunting goal. You think, let's say, 70 to 100,000 words you're wanting to write, and how long that will take and how much time to write something like that. But I've written so many more words than that in the last, just the last year. Year and a half, but certainly over the last 10, just the tremendous number of words that I've written. But the reason is because I've got a bulletin and I can write a 1,000-word article today without too much trouble. And it's just the matter of, okay, that's at the end of the rainbow. And if you're looking at that all of the time, well, I just kind of can't do that. I don't have time for it, or it's not going to work. But if you say, okay, I'm going to write 100 words today, and you consistently do that, then it'll take a while, but you'll eventually have 50,000 words or 70,000 words.
You know, you could
talking to myself a little bit.
You could put all of those together, and instead of saying short stories, you could say short sermons.
There you go. That's the way it works. And it is kind of an interesting thing because I've got a thing that I do on the internet. There's a page that on Facebook that me and about 10 other writers write articles for, and they're all based on authority. We call it the Patternist. And so not every week, but every week or two, I write a short, and they're all supposed to be about 400 words or less, and so, get short articles. And I've got two tracks that are compilation of those essays, and about probably enough material for three more tracks as far as the thickness, just on that one little subject. And again, it just is an indication that with time, if you just put yourself to it a little bit, it's a common, the weight goals, exercise goals, reading goals, talking about daily Bible reading, that's one of the things about it. It's, you think, I'm going to read the entire Bible. Wow, that's a big, thick book, but you can do it in a year's time and using 10, 12 minutes a day. It's not that big of a thing to do it if you just put yourself to it. So that accumulation of small goals is something that is very impactful of your life at large. All right?
Sometimes we let our day get all caught up in little things. And before you know it, it's just little things we have accomplished. And the business about change what you do daily. Even if you say, I am going to start exercising. But in your daily life, you go, where am I going to put it? You just do it. And that's it. You got to take food to somebody. You just do it. And that's changing your daily life. And we don't look at it that way. We go, I can't change.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a matter of setting priorities, and if you deem something to be important, you do that day. And by the way, another aspect of this, I think it's especially helpful with regard to devotional time that you spend with the Lord, to set a consistent time. And it typically works best for most people, not everyone certainly, but most people it is a morning thing. In other words, if you get it done first thing.
And I don't do mornings.
You don't do that. So it doesn't work for everyone. And I recognize that.
Yeah, I do it in afternoons, clear through until 3 in the morning. It works for me.
Okay. All right. So, but that's just something to mind. If it's prioritizing, it's doing what is most important. And so you have to, a goal or something you have, that's got to be something that gains importance to you. And again, there are things that have, diminishing returns with regard to significance, depending on what it is you choose to set as your goal. There are people who, they say, I'm gonna become a world champion video game player. Okay, so you're going to spend 10 hours a day playing video games. Well, that's not really a good thing. But when it comes to personal devotion, and that is becoming more intimate in your relationship with God, which requires study, meditation, and prayer, that's a laudable goal that we all should strive for. And the way in which that's accomplished is by spending time every day in those activities. You're spending time with the Lord, either in His Word or in prayer to Him. And that should be important. So what time of day are you going to choose? At what point are you going to set aside other things and say, yes, those are pressing, but this is important, and this is what I'm going to do right now. And that's an important thing. So
if you do it long enough, then it becomes a habit. So.
Yeah. It's hard to reach that point, but once it does, you do. That's true. That's true. There are individuals who say, I can't imagine not doing that, and it's because of how long they have.
Well, I'm in that boat, so if I miss a day, I feel guilty.
It's bothering you.
I haven't talked to the Lord today.
Message your whole day. Yeah, that's good. That's good. It's good to develop habits like that. All right, question number two then. How have you seen people make a mess of their lives? How have you seen? Okay, so I misunderstood that. I answered yes. I was thinking, have you seen people make a mess of their lives? And living by one of the four common life philosophies. But he's asking, how have they done that? And the first one is materialism. So how have individuals ruined their lives through the pursuit of materialism?
Well, you never can get enough.
Okay, so it changes perspective. The pursuit of it becomes all-encompassing, and that can cause neglect in other areas, certainly, and skew perspective. One of the things that happens is we can get just about anything we want at just about any time, at least at some point in our lives. It's called credit. And so I think sometimes young people are this way. You think about in generations past where I had to work so hard and for so long to finally reach that stage where, okay, now I've reached a point where I can own a home, or I've reached a point where I can buy a new car, or I've reached a point where I can have a particular possession, when a lot of times it seems in this generation, and it's maybe just kind of a matter of the instant gratification that's a part of our culture, but you have young people just starting out and they say, I want that and I want it now. And they can get it. It's not good that they get it typically, because what they do is put themselves deep into debt from the beginning. But I don't have the money, but I do have a credit card, or I don't have the money, but I can get a line of credit in this store. And then the next thing comes up, and I'm kind of deeper in debt, but I still can get that line of credit, or I can still use the credit card, and it can be a difficult thing. You can ruin your life in the pursuit of materialism. Of course, the primary point to be, eat, drink, and be merry. You fool, this night your soul is required of you. So you can lose your eternal standing with God in the pursuit of material things. Parable of sower, thorns. That's the seed that fell on the thorns. That's the cares of the world, the riches of life. They choke the word, and that can happen. Playboy culture. If it feels good, do it. How can that destroy your life?
A very selfish individual.
Okay. It can impact relationships then, because you're living for self instead of others. By the way, whenever you're talking about fleshly excess, there are physical consequences. A lot of people, it feels good, do it. Someone drinks and drives, someone gets cancer, someone gets cirrhosis of the liver, gets obese, all of those kinds of things because of excesses that happen. All that is problematic. Sexual disease, that kind of thing. Unwanted pregnancies. The hedonistic lifestyle is... you start off with young adults having a lot of fun, and you end up with middle-aged adults miserable and old adults dying that shouldn't be dying as soon as they are, because the destructive nature of that type of lifestyle happens a lot. I mean, just look at all the rock and roll people. I was reading an article about Ozzy Osbourne. I don't know his name, others do, but he basically is a complete total idiot. His brain cells are all dead, and he's still alive, and he's still on TV, and people still watching. But the reason they do it now is not because they like his music. He's funny because he's an idiot. He's an idiot because he's fried his brain with all the drugs he took in this lifestyle of rock and roll, And so now when he talks, what he says is so stupid it's funny. And that's he's got a reality TV show where he goes from place to place with another guy, a young guy, who's a pretty smart guy. And he plays off of him, and just every episode's about how stupid he is. And he's making money, and I guess he's happy because he doesn't know people are not laughing with him, they're laughing at him.
So sad.
But that's the kind of thing that you see so much of that happening, it's a shame to see. There's another thing I saw recently. It's been a number of years ago, but on the internet is before and after pictures of meth users, and you have these fresh faces of these young people, and then a year later they don't have any teeth, and they're emaciated, and they've got sores on their face and all this kind of stuff, and just how quickly they've changed because they got into that, and so they're definitely. A lot of impact to that idea of it feels good, do it, that is negative. Humanism. Humanism is who needs God? Do what you want to do. And I suppose that in that, when we talked about out that has ruined their lives or impacted their lives, making a mess of their lives, is that if God's not in the picture, then it's messed up, period. I mean, there's not always... I mean, there are a lot of people who will live their entire lives without God in the picture and be just as happy as they can be about it. I saw a man being interviewed, and he said that the belief in God is a belief for... just for fools to give them comfort because they're afraid of dying and turning into dust, like what all we're going to do. You know, every one of us are going to be that way. He didn't care. He was living his life. He felt like he was getting the most out of it for the short period of time he had. And he thought that the people who had their eyes up in the sky were foolish because it was going to happen to them too. Which, by the way, Solomon says, it's going to happen to everybody. But his idea, there wasn't anything past. And so he was, in his mind, getting most out of life and just pretty much happy about it. It's not until eternity where he's going to realize he made a mistake. In the judgment. So, or at least when he dies, that he'll realize that. But there is that spiritual consequence, certainly.
I think a lot of the people, though, that claim to not believe in God and stuff, but then all of a sudden find the need to, well, if he's out there, I want to make sure I can't say that it's too late, but it's like, you know, they kind of wonder, because then you get that fear of what death is or whatever. But
yeah. Not everyone, but there are a lot of people that say there's no atheist in foxholes, and there's some truth to that. That it's not very common. I think that maybe there's a meta narrative that is more impactful here, that the humanistic philosophy that's been so prevalent, that secularized our society, has had very real impacts upon our society in general that are negative. It leads to the playboy culture. It leads to materialism because we're wanting to get as much as we can out of life. It leads to the idea that there are no absolute laws, so right and wrong is what we make it, which is why we've seen so many moral shifts in our culture with regard to sexual sin, with regard to the marriage relationship, with regard to all of those ideas, where now as Christians we are on the intolerant, hateful, evil side because we don't go along with where the world is going. Just an interesting impact, the census, you know, they're arguing about the census right now, and the arguments that they're making about the census is whether illegal aliens... whether it's necessary on the census to put whether you're an American or not, because they say if you put that on there, that you're going to have when they come and knock on your front door to take the census, they're not going to answer because they're afraid if they say no, I'm not an American citizen, that the next day there's going to be the immigration officers knocking on their door. And so what we're trying, you know, what one political party is trying to do is take that question off of it. Seems there's a legitimate reason for the question, you know, so we can know how many actual citizens are in the United States instead of just people. But regardless, as it was being discussed, someone said, well, what about gender? And since we talk about gender today and the changes, instead of saying, are you male or female, how many males do you have in your, you know, are they going to have now the 50 some odd different gender assignments that they say could be, are we going to have that and be broken down by that kind of thing? So, you know, it's silly. It's absolutely absurd. You're either a man or a woman, but not in our society. And now, so if you're the one who says, no, you're either a man or a woman, you know, that's your gender, male or female, you're hateful, intolerant, evil now. It's kind of weird, and that's because God's not in the picture. That's exactly what it is. God's not in the picture. I have the right to determine for myself who I am. If I feel that I am a man in a woman's body, or that my gender is, you know, there's so many of them, and they're so weird that it's hard to even name them. But then I have the right to do that. I have the right to make that determination. If you say, okay, this is what God made me, well, it's pretty easy. I'm either male or I'm a female.
Well, let them write it in then.
Well, I don't know what they're doing about it, and I don't know if anything will be done, because I think that there is that practical aspect. That's what happens is, what you have is this pie in the sky, I should be able to be what I want to be, that is constantly running into reality. So if we do that with the census, where you have these, so we're going to have 50 that we're going to assign. And so we'll go down this list, and you tell me what you are. Well, there's going to be someone that says, well, I'm not on this list because this is the way I identify. So now you still haven't solved the problem. But at the next point is that you need to have that data. It's important. It's significant to have the data for any number of purposes, not just for the census, but other things. Is a person a male or is a person a female? It's important to know that. And so even as you have these individuals saying we need to let people be who they are, there are practical considerations that run contrary to that because we're living in the real world, not in this fairyland that these people are involved in. And the farther and farther away we get from that, the more unworkable society becomes. So that's kind of the point that I'm making, is that the society in general has been altered significantly because God's no longer in the picture. And things that are normal are now all of a sudden considered to be unacceptable. Things that are truly abnormal and indicate even sickness are being championed. And it's because we want people to say, I can do what I want. So that's kind of a big picture part of that that may be more impactful than one individual.
Maybe they'll just come up with a man, woman, or something else.
Other.
Other.
But people will be offended by that too. I'm not an other. This is what I'm going to do.
Let them write the book and have a blank one and fill it in.
It's weird. Okay, the fourth philosophy, making messy life because of fatalism. That's the one probably as Christians we can maybe just in periods of despair we can fall into more than maybe the others. I guess Christians can be caught up in materialism for sure. But see that happen. I'm sorry, page question number two is tied in with page 41.
Because you're before.
So how can we make a mess out of our lives with the fatalistic? You live, you die, that's all there is.
Well, if you believe that, why not have it all now?
Okay.
Because you would have no hope for, there's no eternity. There's no life ever after. So why not sin all you want? Who cares? You know, there's no devil. There's no...
And basically, that's what Solomon is saying he did, because he was looking for joy, he was looking for something significant to hang his hat on without God in the picture. And what he came to the conclusion after having done it is no, it's not there. And I suppose some people can convince themselves, well, it really is. But what he's saying is that, you know, yeah, I think that going and having fun is what's best in life. But, you know, that gets old. And it really, the pursuit of money, I want to make a lot of money, and that's fun, yeah, but I'm not satisfied even though I've gotten this much, I want more. So that's not giving me the joy that I want. So that's definitely where you go with it. That's the whole point of the text, is that you begin to say, God's not in the picture, let me get the most out of life. But Solomon's saying, I did that, and I found out really that there's no value to that. So that's very, very surely a problem.
I was going to say, and the irony in that is it may look like your life is very full. In reality, it's very empty. Yeah. You never have that status. You're never satisfied.
That's exactly right. And that is. That's what vanity is. It's looking for something to fill your life and finding out that all these things that you're doing, there's no ultimate value in that. Yeah, and again, that concept of despair, I think the humanistic point of view, one of the things that when I preach on Ecclesiastes, I had a sermon that I did, and I've emphasized the fact this is the humanistic view of life, that you go in, there's no God, so get the most out of life. And then you get to the end of your life, and it becomes very fatalistic, where the end of humanism is nihilism. And the nihilist is an individual who's sought to gain the things that life has to offer, and in the end come to the realization that I've not made any difference. No one's going to remember me. My life has been useless and worthless. And a lot of humanists reach that point because as they near death, God's not in the picture. They don't believe in God, and they look it back, and especially the ones, the humanists that are of a mind to change the world, because the world doesn't change. Okay, it's been evil. And part of the reason why this world's so evil is because the superstitious of those religious nuts. So I'm going to change the world. I'm going to enlighten everyone. You get to the end of your life and everything is exactly the way it was when you started your pursuit of these things, and you come to the realization that I've wasted my entire life. I've been an idealist. I've been trying to effect a change, and I've been doing it for 50 years. And at the end of it, I'm going to die and it's going to be forgotten and it was all worthless. And that's nihilism. And that's the end of a lot of humanists, is they become nihilists. But the point is that there are good things in this life and bad things in this life. Accentuate the good, enjoy the good, live through the bad, go to heaven. All right, there's a lot more good to be said about that than wasting your life in pursuit of something that you'll never attain. And that's what Solomon is trying to point out here. All right, question number three then. According to verse 1, what life truth should guide us?
Our life is in God's hands.
Life in God's hands. God's in control. Verse 2, what do all have in common?
Death.
Death. That's exactly right. So the follow-up, I'm going to read this just because it confuses me. See what you have to say. Okay, so this is the Monopoly board. We buy railroads, park place, sell, or drive around the board, collect $200 when we pass go. Eventually someone wins with a stash of cash and hotels and wipes out everyone else. Then comes the greatest lesson in the game called Monopoly. It all goes back in the box. What's the message for us? Anybody have a message from that?
You don't really have all that stuff. When you die, what did it mean? Did you gain the world?
Yeah.
Well, where you go with Monopoly, you put it back in the box.
And it's not yours.
You don't have that.
Wow, I missed that entirely. Thank you.
I used to always tell the kids.
I was trying to figure out what's the lesson here. Well, life goes on without us. In other words, the next time somebody else is going to be playing, maybe, you know, the life ends, but our existence continues. Go back to the box, life is over, and we're still here. I just tried to figure out what he meant by that, but I guess that's probably it. Because it never was ours, really,
right,
in the first place.
I used to tell the kids in America, every Friday in our household was game night or whatever, and every time we'd play Life or Monopoly, I would tell them that everything was big, but in life, this is God's game. He makes the rules, he gives the prize.
And were they rolling their eyes, or did you see them rolling their eyes?
They still know that one today.
Okay, good.
But I would always tell them, I said, this is God's board game. He makes the rules.
When they turn their faces away from you, they're rolling their eyes. Yeah. That's what kids do when parents give live lessons when you're playing board games. It's a good thing you did it. But when you were saying, I can see my kids going, oh, here goes Dad again. Teach them those lessons. All right. Question number 5. Given the busyness of life, not the business, but the busyness of life, how can I prioritize my spouse? And I think that there, the reference is to verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which is given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that's your portion in life. So I think what he's asking for is practical advice. How can I prioritize my spouse? Does anyone have any practical advice with regard to any of that? It might be helpful to any of us.
I think just work together. You're striving to both for godly lovers. But as in a household, you're a team. So just seek each other's best.
We always need to remember that, not to, it's easy, especially when you have children who are in the home, that the children become more important. And it's important to recognize that the closest relationship, most important relationship, is that of the husband and wife. And it's going to be more effective and more beneficial for the children if that proper structure is maintained.
Something that I saw early, which in our first married with the kids or whatever, really hard because he'd be gone for, you know, sometimes months at a time or whatever. When he came home, he was super cool. Dad, Mom was the mean one. I held all of discipline. But I remember telling him one time, I said, we always have to provide or always have to present an even front. I said, because when those kids are gone, it's just you and me. When they're gone out of that house, you know, no more cool dad. It's just me. So, but I mean, we had to, you know, that was something that we had to work toward. But it is common in a lot of households where you'll see parents playing off of one another, and kids do that.
Yeah.
But it starts out as husband and wife, and that's where it ends up. The kids, as much as you try to raise them as Christian ones.
it eventually goes back to just you two. So
18 to 20 years in a life together is not a long time. It thinks it seems like it is when you're in the middle of it. It's really not. All right, anybody else? Next question, stop making excuses regarding life, waiting until this or that happens. Solomon advises us to stop waiting to live. Why is that?
First thing you know, those years are gone. You do what you can do now.
And the idea here is to enjoy life. And again, keeping in mind that to eat, drink, and be merry, go for the gusto, get all you can out of this life because it's the only one you have, that those are legitimate as long as God's in the picture. And the problem is, so often, whenever we see the admonitions against such things in the New Testament is because individuals were doing that instead of serving God. But this life has been created for us to enjoy and to receive blessings. And so as long as God's in the picture and we're serving Him first, then it is right and proper for us to enjoy our lives. And so these last couple of questions, I mean, this idea like eating corn on the cob instead of being neat about it, just dig in, let the butter run down your chin. That's he's saying. That's what Solomon is recommending. And, you know, I mean, the person who takes their corn on the cob and they cut the corn off the cob with a knife, that irritates me. Pick it up and eat it. Well, I know.
That's what makes it so good.
Yeah. I like it, but yeah.
Oh, I get what I get tickled is when little kids, and I'm thinking of Sawyer and Emberly. It's fun to watch them eat corn on the cob.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what Solomon's talking about. Or that's what he's saying Solomon's talking about. Okay, and then the scale of 1 to 10, least to the greatest. What kind? Okay, we can't answer this because it's morning, but what kind of day did you have today and what did you learn that will make tomorrow better? So let's think about what kind of day did you have yesterday and what did you learn that will make today better? Does anyone want to add anything to that? You know, these kinds of questions, this guy is an optimist and I'm a realist. I'm not a pessimist, but I'm not an optimist per se, and I've got to strive to be more optimistic. But if you think about this, if every day you make every day better than the one before it, that's kind of a lot of days. And you know, so I understand incremental, but there's nothing in that to say, okay, some days are going to be good and some days are going to be bad, and some of them are. And that's the realism in me that says, argh. But there are lessons to be learned from here. Lessons that, for example, if I've had a successful day for whatever reason, what did I do to make that a successful day and how can I incorporate it in the next day? Those are good things. So attitude, as much as the activity itself, what was my attitude on that day I had? What was my approach to that? Can I duplicate that? Is there something I can do? Those are beneficial things. And, of course, the application of those things in spiritual areas. There's a plaque that a preacher friend of mine had above his desk, and it said, you're too busy today to not start your day in prayer. And so that was kind of something he wanted to remind himself of. And apparently, you know, maybe sometimes he just got so busy he didn't take the time to pray. So he wanted to remind himself of that. And, you know, we talked about it. I asked him about it. And he said, yeah. He said, you know, my day always goes better if I start my day in prayer. And so that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. Anybody want to add anything to that or...
End your day in prayer.
End your day in prayer. Good. Okay. Just something to keep in mind is if you figure something out one day, try to carry it over to the next as far as success and joy and proper attitude, and that will be beneficial to you. Okay, that gets us through the ninth chapter. Anybody have anything you want to add to chapter 9? Well, let's get started in the 10th. There are a few things that we can note, and let's just start with the title. Stink flies in the onion. Yeah, and it's a reference there in chapter 10 of the first verse that dead flies putrefy. The perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor, and he compares that with a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. So that is an individual who is otherwise respected, but something happens in his life that is foolish, and it can ruin the whole smell. And he gives some examples on the next page that I think are kind of interesting to point that out. I've seen this story that he talks about, and of the eagle who thinks he's a prairie chicken. And it's kind of interesting. And the point that he makes in regard to this that I think comes up through the entirety of that 10th chapter is the having an improper perspective in life that makes you foolish. And foolishness, as he'll point out, is when we talk about foolishness, it's not a person who's trying to be funny. Foolishness is a life that is directed away from God instead of toward God. And so when we talk about the wise men of the world, the apostle refers to this, is that the wisdom of man is, or the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of man. And so when we make that contrast, you've got an awful lot of people in the world today who are perceived by the world as being wise. And I'll give you an example of this. And the example that comes to my mind is the physicist that just died. And I was about to say Hawking. Thank you. Stephen Hawking, not Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is also an atheist. But Stephen Hawking is an interesting individual, very successful, and very successful despite the fact of a very severe illness that he contracted while young. He was a brilliant physicist. His world was ahead of him, and he got, I think it's muscular dystrophy, maybe multiple sclerosis. I can't remember which one, but he's confined to a wheelchair for the last 50 years of his life. Died at age 76, I think. And he couldn't talk, so he had a computer basically attached to his wheelchair. And I'm not exactly sure how he would do it, but through blowing on a tube or whatever, he would painstakingly type letters in a computer synthesized voice would speak for him. He would hold lectures. Very interesting fellow. And he, of course, a theoretical physicist, is an individual who is interested in figuring out where life came from. Where the universe came from and how it came about. And he postulated things about the Big Bang and such. And one of the ideas that he has is that before the Big Bang, there was nothing. Kind of an interesting thing. And has these mathematical computations which could possibly, if they are sufficiently proven, give credence to the fact that something came out of nothing, which is kind of a weird thing. But that's that goes against science. But what science has always had a problem with is this constant state of matter. Because if matter is constant in the universe, matter has always existed. Well, how did it get there? And how did that dead inert matter get to where it is now? And there's really no answer for it. In other words, the way science seeks to describe things, the universe as it exists today can't happen. And so you've got theoreticians who go back and they try to figure all this out. They're brilliant individuals. They've got IQs 175. Their minds work different than ours do. And some magnitudes of difference between their intelligence and our intelligence. The wisdom, the foolishness of God is wiser than those men. And but people look at Stephen Hawking, and they think to themselves, you know, if God really existed, Stephen Hawking would believe in him because he's the smartest guy on earth. You know, this kind of thing. They place their trust in men like that, Albert Einstein and others like that. They're our gods in our society today. They really are, and they're fools because Psalm 14 says the fool in his heart has said there is no God. And these individuals have the audacity to actually say it out loud. So they're even more foolish than the one who keeps quiet about it. But that's the people, those are the individuals who are, they're giants in their field. They've furthered our understanding of the universe. As time continues, they're going to explain how the universe came into existence. And, I mean, these theories that are out there, they've got one that's called string theory, that in its theory explains how the universe is as it is, because the idea is there are an infinite number of universes and we're just in one of the infinite variations, and in a lot of the variations nothing's working right and they, you know, don't continue because it's all by chance. But if you have enough of them, chance works it out to be this way. And okay, so that's one way of describing it, you know, because we say, how can chance lead to such complex working parts? God created it that way. That's easy for us. For them, it's, well, I don't know. It doesn't seem like that would work that way. But if there were infinite numbers of universe verses, surely one of them would have it this way. You know, by chance, it would happen that way. And that's string theory. That's a part of string theory, is a reason or explaining how. And there are people who are trying to mathematically, scientifically, prove the string theory. And, you know, that's where they spend their entire lives doing. And what do black holes have to do with it? Where, you know, what was the singularity in the beginning? And they go through all this process and they try to develop these things. That's men who are striving to explain things without God in the picture. And they're extolled in our society as being the wise individuals, and what the Bible calls them are fools. And so this story that is given here of the eagle who thinks he's a prairie chicken is one that's helpful in that regard, because in illustrating this, he talks about he was born after being set as an egg set upon by a prairie chicken. And so all his life he was an eagle, but he thought he was a prairie chicken, so he scratched in the dirt for seeds and insects, clucked, cackled. He flew low to the ground. That's how prairie chickens are supposed to fly. And then he saw a magnificent bird one day soaring in the heavens. He said, "What is that beautiful bird?" And the prairie chicken said, "That's an eagle. But don't give it a second thought. You could never be like him." So he spent the rest of his life as a prairie chicken. and it's kind of a funny story. I doubt very seriously true, because eagles don't think they're prairie chickens. But the fact is that you can spend your entire life searching for and looking and having this perspective that it colors every thought. And you can rationalize and explain everything within the construct of what you think it to be. And that's what happens when God's not in the picture. And I've used this illustration before, but I have a quote, and I think it's from Ernst Mayr. He was an evolutionary biologist, Harvard professor. He's since dead. But I've had this quote in my filing cabinet for 30 years. Actually probably 35 years. But his quote is that evolution does not give us a satisfactory explanation as how life in its present form exists. He said, but the only other possible explanation is God, and that can't be true. But that's the problem. But he's talking to other people who believe the same way he did. So there is the possibility, there is this supernatural intervention. We know that's not so. So now we've got to explain it. Well, evolution is basically the best thing we've got so far. So let's keep working at it and trying to figure it out and make it fit better. That's their perspective. And they spend the entirety of their lives and their focus on trying to bring that about, having rejected as implausible the actual explanation. And so when you do that, everything is centered in explaining things in that way. Then yes, you are going to be able to rationalize and to fit everything into your perspective. People do that all the time. We do that. That's what we're doing. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We're hoping for something that we will not see until we die. We are placing our trust in a God that none of us have ever seen or can see. That's faith. Now, I think there's legitimate a foundation for our faith, but it nevertheless is faith that we have, and it colors our perspective and everything. People say, you know, you're being so simplistic when we give you all these explanations of the universe as it is, and your simple answer is God made it that way. That's so simplistic. That doesn't help us. Well, it may not help you scientifically, but that's what happened. And it's simple. It's a simple answer. But it's not simplistic because God isn't simplistic. You know, God is omnipotent. God is omnipresent. God fashioned this complex world by the power of His Word, because He can do that. Foolishness of God is wise in the wisdom of men. And so, yeah, it's an amazing place that we live in. And how it can be that the earth is less than 10,000 years old, and yet we have light that is shining from stars that are billions of light years away. How could that be? God made it that way. That's, you know, God said, "Let there be light," and this is what I, this is my view of it. And I actually there's an elder church in Pasadena where Jerry Fife preaches that he gives explanations. He's a doctor and he's got a scientific background. He explains how it could be that the starlight is here based upon scientific principles. And it may be legitimate because he can't accept just what I say in that regard. But my view is the stars existed, stars that are billions of light years away, where if the world is only 10 years old, he creates those stars, the light wouldn't get here until 10 billion years later. That's the way light works. It tries to travel at a constant speed, gets here. But he made the stars for us. So he not only made the stars, but he made the light from the stars in that instant to where it helped us, benefited us. Why would he do it that way? Because that's what he desired for us. He wanted for us, and he is the creator that accomplishes his desire. And it's a simple answer, but it's not simplistic because he's God. And so scientists don't like that perspective, but that's a perspective that we have. And theirs is different. And because theirs is different, they spend their entire lives as eagles thinking they're prairie chickens. That's a pretty interesting point to make.
When I was in high school, I went to a Catholic school. When I was in school, we had to take biology. But the state still requires that you teach, what's the opposite of Christian?
Evolution.
So, but yet I'm fascinated by science, so I've always loved it.
Sure.
But in there, I knew, you know, when they show the progression of apes, you know, all that stuff, and you kind of chuckle because you know that this isn't true. When you look at all the fascinating scientists that we have today, then you look at Solomon, who was wiser than them, yet he still had that perspective of he knew what was, as much as we don't want to see it, we're simple-minded, very simple-minded compared to what God is. You know, and he had that perspective where they can't accept it. They can't accept that something, it just is. They have to, and it's like being on a hamster wheel. They're just going to keep going round and round. It's futile.
Well, yeah, and it is. And you think about it right now with the big pursuit is where did life come from? And so billions of dollars have been spent trying to figure out where life came from. You read Genesis 1 and you find it, but they'll never, of course, finally fully ultimately answer that question. If they were to find life on Mars, and that's, I've read an article just recently. If they found life on Mars, what they would find, or the evidence of past life on Mars, they weren't looking for green Martians walking on, you know, 2 feet and with technical prowess. They're just looking for some single cell life. Wouldn't prove anything. It wouldn't accomplish anything. It wouldn't tell us where life came from on Earth from a scientific viewpoint. It simply wouldn't. It would say, okay, there was some microscopic amoebas on Mars, and you know, by the way, I don't think that. But I don't know that. If there is other life on other planets, there could be, I suppose. It just doesn't make sense to me from the Bible point of view, but I do recognize that the Bible point of view is based upon humanity, and if God created life on other planets for some reason, then that's not something that would apply to us at all. We wouldn't know about it. But so I think that people saying as soon as we find life on another planet, or as soon as, if we find life on Mars, then the Christian religion will be then irrelevant. It'll be shown to be false. No, it wouldn't. I wouldn't say anything about that. But having said that, all that reveals is that there was some microbes on another planet. That's all it tells us. And by the way, they were put there by God as well. It's ridiculous. But you're right. The pursuit, and it seems to me that, you know, okay, let's put somebody on Mars because it's going to take technology and it's going to increase and it's going to make life better for us, because much of the things we've got today come about as a result of man on the moon. You know, a lot of the technological improvements and everything. But trying to find life, just to find life, you know.
Well, doesn't it take years and years and years to get to Mars?
Yeah.
So,
hey, if they want to go, let them go. Let them go. And if you create something that makes my cell phone better because you work real hard to do it, that's fine too. But why are you going? Are you going to further scientific knowledge? Or are you going because you're trying to find the meaning of life? The meaning of life's found in Scripture. Oh boy, preached it.
It devolved. Is that there have been smart scientists since the world began? Then Solomon certainly talks about them. All right, all of these smart men from all of this time, and they can't solve the problem, and that doesn't say anything to them.
Well, we've made progress, though. That's the point. Yeah, there are a couple of terms that are used for it, and I'm trying to remember what it is, but it's basically the arrogance of our position or time. Everyone else who lived before us, they were ignorant. We are smarter than they are. We are, you know. And the amazing thing about that, it's called the pride of place or the pride of position or something. I forget now the words that are used to describe it. But I thought that was so pointed, so appropriate when I read that, is that every generation that comes along, they talk about how ignorant the generation before them was and how much better, smarter they are. And it all has to do with technological progression. We have invented new things and we have furthered our knowledge in certain areas, natural areas. And so everybody else before was ignorant. And that's why you'll have someone who says, okay, sure, all 38 of our presidents, the good ones and the bad ones, let's say we have 15 good presidents in the United States. They were great presidents. Yeah, they all believed in the Bible and they all believed in the creation account. But if you say that you believe in the Bible, your creation account, you're not qualified to serve as the president anymore. Yeah. Wait, you've already had 15 that have done that and made it. But, you know, there are a couple of individuals. Rick Santorum, for example, is that one of his, when his candidacy, 10 years ago, whenever for presidency, it faltered. One of the primary reasons was because he said, I'm a young earth creationist. I believe that God created the earth and it happened to us in 2,000 years ago. Well, you can't be president. Well, that's what George Washington believed. That's what Abraham Lincoln believed. That's what, yeah. And they're the great presidents. But because you believe that, all of a sudden the world would stop working if you were to be president, because now you're ignorant and dumb. And so that's that prejudice of time. And when you look at the education, the ability of let's say high school kids to read Latin and to and have this proficiency that they had back then, read the letters that were written by just average folks and the grammar that was used and the complexity of the sentences and the thoughts. And then you go and you look at the papers that Josh's kids turn in for history.
We're going backwards in some ways.
One girl said, would you tell me something about the Silver War? Because I'm confused about the Silver War. That happened his first year of teaching, and you thought, oh no, what have I taught myself into? The Silver War. Yeah, but that kind of stuff happens to them all the time. It's just
written that one on the blackboard.